Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Good Monday to you. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting this program at KUOW, so come join us. As Americans were celebrating Gay Pride Month, the U.S. Supreme Court has been studying same-sex marriage. 2 weeks ago, the court ruled that a Colorado baker was discriminated against for refusing to make a cake for a same-sex wedding. And here in Washington State, we wondered at that time, is this going to affect the Eastern Washington florist? Arlene's Flowers in Richland refused to provide floral arrangements to a same-sex couple. Well, today the Supreme Court released its decision on Arlene's Flowers versus State of Washington. And here with the story is New York Times Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak. Hi, Adam.
It's good to be here.
Will you remind us first, for those who don't remember, what is this case with Arlene's Flowers? What was that about?
It's one of these many cases where people who provide services for weddings don't want to participate in weddings because they have religious objections to same-sex marriage. So the case the Supreme Court looked at a couple weeks ago involved a baker in Colorado who didn't want to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. This Washington State case involves a florist who doesn't want to make a floral arrangement for a same-sex wedding.
And these were longtime clients. I think they called each other friends at one point.
That's right. And I think in all likelihood, these are sincerely held religious objections, but they run up against anti-discrimination laws that say businesses open to the public can't pick and choose whom they're going to serve. And the clients say that there's no religious override. An anti-discrimination law applies even when you say you have a religious objection to serving the customer.
Yes, there is a Washington state law along these lines.
Right.
This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the Washington state case, the Arlene's Flowers case. Why did they send it back to the Washington state Supreme Court?
This is a fairly common practice at the U.S. Supreme Court. When they decide a case in a general area, they will often send related cases back to the lower courts to say, hey, have a fresh look at what you did last time. Is there anything in what we just did that will make you change your mind?
And do you think there is?
I think there's not. So in the Colorado case, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the court basically went off on an idiosyncratic ground applicable to that case only. So the question in that case was a clash between gay rights on the one hand and claims of religious freedom on the other. The court didn't give us an answer on that. All it said was that the baker in that case had not been fairly treated by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission because one of its commissioners said bigoted things.
Yes.
So that's a special case determination. And in sending the Washington case back to the Washington Supreme Court and say, have another look at this and see if anything we said makes a difference, I think in all likelihood the Washington Supreme Court will uphold its earlier decision because there was not that kind of bigotry in the record in the Washington case.
Will you remind us, Adam, what that bigoted language was?
It was to the effect of religion has been used to justify horrible things, including slavery and the Holocaust. So one commissioner on a civil rights commission definitely seemed to have some anti-religious animus, and Justice Anthony Kennedy, writing for the Supreme Court, said that was enough to rule for the baker because he was not treated fairly. But there's nothing like that in the record in the Arlene's Flowers case.
So the one Colorado civil rights commissioner admitted to being hostile to religious freedom claims?
I don't think he'd go quite that far, and I think there are people in the world who would say that religion has been used to justify slavery. But the U.S. Supreme Court may be looking for a way out of that case, may be looking for a way to duck the issues, as it again seemed to do today, went off on that idiosyncratic ground, that ticket for one ride only ground, instead of deciding what is really a major clash that, remains needing to be decided about whether there's a religious exception to anti-discrimination laws.
Okay, so we don't have the bigoted language in the Washington State case. Do you have any sense of the likelihood that the Washington State Supreme Court will change their decision on this?
I would be very surprised if they change their decision. I don't think they've been asked to reconsider their decision in light of the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision, in light of the Colorado decision. Because there doesn't seem to be anything in the Washington case record resembling what went on in Colorado, I think it's a very good bet that they're going to uphold their earlier decision, and that will tee up the case to go back to the U.S. Supreme Court if the justices want to hear it.
So after these two cases, Adam, has the U.S. Supreme Court told us anything about their take on the religious right to not serve someone?
Well, they kind of talked out of both sides of their mouth in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, but lower courts have already started to interpret it as a pro-gay rights case. So an Arizona appeals court, just days after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, said that someone who makes cards and decorations for a wedding couldn't discriminate against gay couples, and quoted at length from the U.S. Supreme Court decision. So there's plenty in the U.S. Supreme Court decision that courts that want to uphold anti-discrimination laws can do. And just to be clear, courts around the nation have consistently said that there is no religious exception to anti-discrimination laws.
This is Adam Liptak, the New York Times U.S. Supreme Court reporter, telling us about today's decision, the sort of a non-decision. The U.S. Supreme Court sent that Arlene Flowers Flores case back to the state of Washington. And in Washington state, we do have a law saying that someone who provides these services cannot use a religious objection to deny them a service. And the gay couple, in this case in Richland, won that case. But it continues. Adam, thanks for giving us the rundown on this.
Really good to be here, Bill.
Good to be with you. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be right back. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. When I hear virtual reality, I think headset. You put on a headset and it looks like you're really on that Starfleet ship, or you're really on a climbing wall. You turn your head and you can see this whole 360 world all around you. It seems fun. It doesn't seem intimate or social to me, but there's a new book about VR called Future Presence: How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. The author is an editor at Wired named Peter Rubin. Peter, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Will you start with some examples of the kind of virtual reality we're going to be talking about?
Sure. I mean, this has a huge range of types of experiences. I think a lot of people may have become familiar with it over the past few years, thinking about it as a gaming technology, as something that was going to make video games more immersive than they ever had been before. But very quickly, it became clear that this technology was going to have kind of transformative applications for everything from healthcare to education to entertainment.
Healthcare meaning you're talking with your doctor in virtual reality?
It could be as easy as connecting with your doctor in virtual reality, and it could be as seemingly far-flung, but certainly already happening, like surgeons rehearsing a tricky procedure in VR before they have to do it in real life. An example of this is there was a pediatric surgeon in Miami a few years ago who had to operate on an infant and later attributed his success with this operation to the fact that he had been able to, using a 3D reenactment or a reconstruction of the baby's heart in virtual reality, essentially do a dry run of the procedure.
Okay, so gaming, healthcare, you were naming a bunch of others.
Architecture and design, manufacturing, certainly therapeutic applications for everything from PTSD to chronic pain to social anxiety and phobia disorders, and for just social platforms, you know, what we have come to think of as social media, but something that's much more immersive and hopefully much less toxic than those things have become.
Now, Peter, I have in the past thought of virtual reality, possibly because I'm old. I have thought of it as an isolating thing. It's just me and some goggles. Why do you say virtual reality really is about intimacy?
Well, it certainly looks that way. It looks isolating, right? We know what we see when we see somebody who's using VR. So we see them wearing a headset. They can't see us. Whatever they're doing in there must be solitary and isolating. But while that can certainly be the case, in reality, what they are truly experiencing could be something that is self-directed, something like meditation or mindfulness that is truly helping them become a better person, or it could be something in which they are connecting with other real people just inside a virtual environment. We're very used to FaceTime and Skype bringing us together, but an embodied version of that would be hanging out with a loved one who's on the other side of the country, sitting on the same virtual couch, watching Netflix together. It could be as pedestrian as that, and it could be as fanciful as sitting together on a space station orbiting the planet and just making small talk.
But I know it's simulated, right?
Well, what's simulated is our surroundings. And
right.
simulated is the fact that each of us is given an avatar. So we look as much like ourselves as is permitted by the kind of aesthetic dicta of the platform that we're using. What makes it not simulated is that you are speaking with your voice, the other person is hearing your voice, and more importantly, the other person is seeing the way your head and your hands move. And so your mannerisms come through, your true self comes through in a way that isn't something that we would have predicted years ago when this text started up.
And what happens inside me when I'm experiencing that more intimate way of connecting with someone than someone on a screen?
Well, certainly. So this all goes back to a phenomenon in virtual reality that's called presence. And that is when the experience is strong enough and comfortable enough that your rational brain is never going to forget that you're wearing a headset. But the rest of your brain accepts the laws of the virtual world as being where you are. And so your physical and emotional responses will be in tune not with what's going on outside of the headset, but the stimuli that you're being presented with inside the headset. So that could mean a conversation with someone else, a romantic interlude with someone else, something truly fantastic, going into a movie and interacting with characters. So what happens when you come out of VR is that the memories that you have of experiences that you have in VR are indistinguishable from the memories that we have of real life, meaning the way your brain stores and retrieves those memories. This isn't like any other form of media we've had before where you remember a movie you've seen, and it's more like remembering a photograph or remembering a scene in a book that you imagine yourself. When you leave VR, the memory that you have is the memory that lasts. So if your memory is, I was on a business trip, and so my wife and I got into VR together, and we spent some time just hanging out and talking about our day, but we did it on a panda preserve in China, that's going to be your memory.
That I was actually in China.
This happened.
Yeah. Do you see downsides to this intimacy with a partly simulated
sure,
universe?
Sure. I mean, well, there are a couple here. And the one that most people are concerned about, and then I'm not particularly, is the idea of finding something in VR that you can't find otherwise and unplugging from the real world. It's a kind of this classic dystopian scenario with any new technology. That's going to become more fraught when artificial intelligence becomes more powerful and starts populating VR with more people and characters that are actually run by AI. So we saw a version of this with the movie Her, in which the protagonist's relationship with the Siri-like virtual assistant in his phone became this person that he talked to all day long. We're already seeing that happen with our relationships with Siri and Alexa and Cortana.
We distinguish less and less. We say thank you to Alexa, right? As if that matters, because it's a she.
That's right. And when Siri and Alexa have a body in VR and we see them and we speak with them and we spend time with them in VR, then that relationship, those lines will blur even more. The two that trouble me the most as far as their potential is the sins of social media in the form of toxic behavior and sexual harassment and verbal abuse being revisited a thousandfold in VR. And the reason I say that is you have a body in virtual reality, this phenomenon of embodiment as an avatar, and that means you have personal space. And so as horrible as someone can be to you on Facebook or Twitter or a direct message or screaming in your ear playing a video game, when that person can really walk up to you and say something horrible and hurtful into your ear, or worse, put their hands in your personal space towards your face or towards your body, while you may not feel on your body where they are touching your avatar's body, at least right now, that will become something that's possible.
You don't have that psychic distance.
You don't have that psychic distance. And so any trauma, or as we've come to think of them, these kind of micro traumas that people can experience online, that becomes all the more visceral for being embodied. So certainly building experiences and spaces that aren't just giving users tools of safety and empowerment, but disincentivizing that kind of behavior.
How would you disincentivize meanness?
How would you disincentivize meanness? Well, one thing that kind of works in the favor of goodness is that it's much harder to be truly horrible to somebody when you're looking in their eyes and walking up to them. I think
we found that to be true with the social media.
Yeah, it's much easier to be horrible from far away when all you're doing is pressing a key. But because of the embodiment in VR and because of presence in VR, it's going to take a harder core breed of misanthrope to be able to do that. But at the same time, it's incumbent on the people who are building these worlds and building these experiences to make sure that there is recourse for people who have suffered this or...
Recourse? What kind of recourse could there be? What measures?
Well, right now, the a very easy, simple version of a user empowerment tool is in a social VR platform called Rec Room, actually headquartered here in Seattle. If someone comes into your personal space or is talking to you in a way you don't like, you hold up your hand in the kind of universal talk to the hand gesture. Uh-huh. And when you do that, they disappear from your view. And that's something that has an analog on something like Twitter where you can mute somebody, but they're just gone. Now, that's the beginning of a solution because while they're gone to you, they're not gone to everybody else who's in that room. So everybody else in that room can still watch that person gesturing to you or getting in your personal space, even though it doesn't register with you. So it helps you as the user who is being confronted with this sort of abuse, but it doesn't disincentivize the behavior of the bad actor.
Might not help your reputation, and you're not there to know what's being said
about
you.
There's also that, certainly.
Yeah. What about the danger of me not knowing what's real? I could get scammed.
Yeah. So the other kind of dark timeline for this is fraud in its many forms. And some people have phrased this to be things of the kind of following from the fake news.
Like living that fake news.
Living that fake news. So rather than just sending you stories that aren't real or coloring editorial coverage or what have you, it is tainting an experience to emotionally manipulate you in some way or to have a lasting effect. And certainly the way people are treated in VR has lasting effects outside the headset as well. If you're ostracized by a group of people in VR, you will take on antisocial behavior in real life. And at the same time, if you are the beneficiary of pro-social behavior in VR, people help you, you'll reenact that model that you've seen outside of the headset. So it stands to reason that the worse someone is treated in VR, whether through abuse or through fraud, fake news, scams, that will be revisited in the outside world as well.
I'm talking with Peter Rubin, editor at Wired and author of the book Future Presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. Here's an example of a simulation that we don't like. If we consider pornography to be turning sex into something detached and dehumanizing, will virtual reality porn be an improvement?
In its early years, interestingly enough, VR porn is counterintuitively kind of making the pendulum swing the other way. As pornography moved from artwork to film to VHS to DVD and then online to streaming, it became much more decontextualized, right? It turned from movies into scenes and scenes into clips and clips into GIFs. And so sex has been rendered as this sort of fantasy of extremity, and it's just little snapshots here and there. Because of the way filmmaking works in virtual reality, the things that we've become used to in our regular movies, like quick cuts and things like that, those don't work in VR. They're incredibly disorienting. So what emerged in the early days of adult companies creating content in VR are two things. One is that it needed to be much more of an uninterrupted experience. Two, the hallmarks that that VR can deliver that video can't, eye contact and a feeling of presence and physical presence, means that people wanted the hallmarks of intimacy in their adult content. They wanted eye contact. They wanted a lot of whispering. There's one company that made experiences that explicitly cropped out penetration, which has long been the hallmark of pornography as people have popularly thought about it, because instead it was concentrating on the face and the body of the person that you were with and the reactions that they were having to the illusion of you. And so immediately what took off in VR porn is completely antithetical to the way that porn has been evolving or maybe devolving, depending on your stance on the matter. And so while this has a long way to go, certainly we're seeing people bring it into less of a recorded scripted content and into live things like live camming, which has been one of the only money-making sides of the adult industry in recent years. People are doing that in VR, and it allows for kind of an incredible connection between the sex worker and the client, so to speak.
So there's some of this. I thought we were talking about the future.
Oh, it's
and
now.
There's a lot more now than I know.
Yeah, the VR first became available in a real easy way in 2015 and 2016. And even by that point, people had been working for 2 or 3 years on working with early prototypes and what does this mean for our industry and what does this mean for our business. So even though we're only 2 to 3 years into this first wave of VR devices, there's been a remarkable amount of experimentation. And that's not to say that we can't extrapolate past what you and I are talking about and bring AI into it. What happens when Siri, Alexa, or some other form of that virtual companion not only has a body, but is algorithmically optimized to provide you the stimulation or the responses that you individually want?
For example?
I'm speaking in sexual terms here, but depending on what haptic feedback looks like in a few years, and haptic feedback refers to the physical feedback we get from virtual stimulation. Right now, it is limited basically to our hands because there are little motors in the hand controllers that you hold while you're using VR, but there are gloves on the market and there are haptic vests on the market. So it's nowhere near being able to simulate human touch and simulate the texture of skin. But in the future, when that becomes available, you are talking about a simulation of sex that is in many ways indistinguishable from reality, but is with a person who is not really a person, with an AI.
How ubiquitous, how soon? Like, give me a sense of when I could expect the average KUOW listener to know exactly what VR worlds I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of kind of watershed moments on the road there, and one of them just happened about a month or two ago, and that is that the first headsets started to hit the market that were completely self-contained. That is, they didn't have to connect to a high-powered PC, they didn't have to connect to a PlayStation game console, and they didn't run off your phone. So became much more convenient. You turned it on, it was Wi-Fi connected, you through an app store-like interface, you could download the experiences you want, and you were off to the races. It's not as immersive as the higher-end headsets, though the wireless standalone version of those are coming. What it's really going to take is a device that combines virtual reality and its cousin, augmented reality, which some people called mixed reality.
Meaning, I know I'm in a room, but I can see things superimposed.
Meaning you see your real world and you see virtual objects within your real world surroundings. So reporting points to the fact that Google and Apple are hard at work on these devices with a projected release date of, some people say 2019, 2020 looks much more likely, if at all. But it stands to reason that if there's any company that can tip this device from a curio to a must-have, it's the company that turns smartphones into iPhones. So if Apple is truly able to create a device that's lightweight, that combines AR and VR into a device so you can use the AR function while you're out in the world or at work, and you can use VR at home, and it's integrated into the Apple ecosystem, then that's the sort of thing that is going to tip this in a very real way. So right now we have the standalone headsets. The next phase is going to be standalone headsets that allow you to move freely in a room, and those are coming in the next year or so. And then past that, 2 to 3 years out is when you're going to start to see the devices that really change the conversation around this technology.
Are you using virtual reality every day in your life?
Just about every day. Yeah.
How?
I have a number of different devices. I've got a room in my house kind of dedicated to this. My wife has become a huge fan. She does a boxing workout in VR. We use it for social purposes. I got my sister's family a couple of headsets so that I'm able to connect with them in social environments. So we're very used to, like I said, speaking with people via Skype and FaceTime. But if you think about what those do, you never make eye contact with the person that you're speaking with. Either you're looking at their phone to see their face, or you're looking at the camera on your phone so that they see you looking at them,
yeah.
But you're never looking into each other's eyes. And VR changes that. So the type of social interaction, the type of quality time that it engenders, is really something that we have not yet experienced using digital means before.
Have you had a personal experience of a change in, as you say in your book, a change in human connection or intimacy?
Yes. Absolutely. For me, well, so, you know, as someone who is happily married, I wasn't in the market for a specific kind of companionship like some people are. And certainly there is a chapter in the book that details the journey of a couple that met and ended up getting married in VR.
Married in VR. Did they get married in real life, too? They have a marriage certificate?
They got married in real life by a justice of the peace.
Which happened first?
They did the real life one because they met in real life.
Okay.
They got engaged the next day. They got married 2 days later because they already knew each other. They already knew each other. They had been...
They had met at virtual reality. Oh, first.
Friends, their conversations had grown deep. And when you meet someone in real life after knowing them in VR, what's remarkable is how they are the same person. Where I think we all know the phenomenon, whether through ourselves or through people we know, of meeting someone in real life who we've gotten to know online, and there's this sense of disconnect. This doesn't match up to the image that I had.
Right.
But because we're speaking with our voices and we're using our hands, and our head and our hands move the way they do in real life, our mannerisms come out. Our true self comes out. And so when people have met in real life after growing close in VR, that sense of disconnect falls away. And so these people met after a long kind of relationship that grew in VR, got engaged the next day, got married 2 days after that by a justice of the peace. Then, so that all their friends could attend, they redid their vows in VR using an officiant in VR, threw a bouquet in VR, cut a cake, had a DJ there. They got married in a gazebo that was not dissimilar to the one they actually got married in.
But their friends could be there. It sounds like then the real ceremony was the virtual
ceremony.
The
real ceremony was, if we think about a ceremony as being a place for our loved ones to share our happiness, that's absolutely where it took place.
Again, this is Peter Rubin, a Wired editor and author of the book Future Presence. Peter, are we eventually, and how soon, not even going to distinguish between VR and real life? Is that a science fiction question to you, or
I really do think it is. I think that there is a far-off scenario in which something that a display that you look at, a head-mounted display, goes away, and instead you talk about direct neural stimulation. And when you get to that point, then you're talking about an indistinguishable reality. That's what the nightmare scenarios like The Matrix are built on. But VR doesn't work that way. No matter how good the headset is, you are always going to know that you are wearing it. You're always going to know that you're having a virtual experience. That's not to say that your emotional responses and even your physical responses aren't going to be consistent with the virtual experience rather than the real world surroundings happening outside the headset. But as VR and AR come together, I don't think that we run any real danger of that becoming a problem.
So maybe I'll still distinguish between virtual reality and the real world, but maybe I'll prefer virtual reality, and I wonder how often I'll prefer virtual reality.
Well, the opiate of the people argument is a troubling one with VR. You know, much has been made of the idea that...
Oh, I don't know that VR isn't going to be better than the real world.
I think in some ways it can be, but the question becomes, while it's a tool of freedom for people who are economically or physically unable to experience things, go places, see things, and VR presents a solution to that, what is the line between being afforded great experiences in VR and using that to ignore every other part of your life? And I don't think that it's a pressing concern, but it's certainly one that is worthy of I think, some contemplation.
If I can dunk in virtual reality, why will I ever play real basketball again?
Let me tell you, having done it, dunking in VR it's every wish fulfillment fantasy of 9-year-old me that it seems like it would be.
I have a little kid hoop for my kid, but I still can't be Michael Jordan even on a small hoop. But you're saying in virtual reality.
There is a sports game that has a dunk contest mini game as part of it. And it is, you get points for being Sean Kemp, Michael Jordan type aeronautics.
Kemp, nice.
Bring it back to a local hero.
Yes.
It's incredible.
I've been talking about the world. I don't know anymore whether it's real or not, honestly. I can't tell you. This has been Peter Rubin, editor at Wired and author of the book Future Presence, How Virtual Reality is Changing Human Connection, Intimacy, and the Limits of Ordinary Life. Let's do this again.
Let's absolutely do this again.
Well, let's do it in VR.
Next time in VR.
Next time. I don't want to see you again unless I can see you virtually.
I've never been happier to hear someone say that.
And coming up on KUOW, it was not virtual reality in the Mariners' dugout. It was just fakery. Ichiro Suzuki disguised himself to get away with being in the dugout against the rules. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It is Monday, and so far, there has still been no disciplinary action against Ichiro Suzuki for his role in the scandal known as Upper Lipgate. Ichiro is no longer a baseball player. He works in the Mariners front office now, special assistant to the team's chairman. And so by Major League Baseball rules, he's not allowed to be in the dugout. Yet there he was in the dugout at Yankee Stadium on Thursday wearing sunglasses, a hoodie, and Mike, would you call it a push broom mustache?
Yeah, the Fuller brush salesman type mustache.
Super Mario Brothers mustache. Yes. Mike Pesca is the host of the Slate podcast, The Gist, and he knows a lot about a lot of things, including sports. Mike, why isn't Ichiro Suzuki allowed in the dugout now?
Well, first of all, I thought the scandal was disguised Gazi. So
sorry, not Upper Lipgate.
East Coast and West Coast have different ways to dub it.
We do.
There's a set number of people who are allowed in the dugout, and if this number is exceeded, of course, it will cause chaos. It will cause being crowded.
Yeah.
And in the past, great players like Johnny Pesky of the Red Sox, he's this beloved octogenarian at the time, and he was on the bench, and Major League Baseball said, no, Johnny Pesky, you cannot be in the dugout. So it is a strictly enforced rule, and there's a logic to the rule.
It just has to do with overcrowding? The fire department code or what? That's it?
Let's break it up. In fact, interpreters can't be in the dugout. A trainer can be in the dugout, but only six coaches, I think, can be in the dugout. Otherwise, it turns out like an NFL sidelines and it just becomes a zoo.
Okay. Do we know why Ichiro Suzuki was in the dugout?
Yes, Ichiro Suzuki, he just loves baseball.
Yeah.
And when he retired or transitioned to his role of special assistant to the chairman, I don't want to take away any of Ichiro's specialness, mm-hmm. he would watch games from the locker room, which they call the clubhouse, because we are, of course, talking about boys here. he would go to the area where they would sometimes swing a bat in terms of getting limber, and he was so excited to rush out onto the field. He just wants to be part of the team and wants to be part of the game. So he said, you know, maybe I'll get away with it. Of course, he tried this out in the biggest media market in America. Although I have a theory about that. Maybe it's just that we found out about it in the biggest media market
right.
in America and has been actually doing this like in Anaheim a lot lately.
Good point. Did he fool no one in Yankee Stadium? Did he get away with it?
I think he did get away with it. You know, he once again got away with capturing our hearts. He's not going to be punished. He's not going to be. The Mariners would not be fine.
Why?
Because I think that this is more or less a victimless crime, because Major League Baseball's attendance is down pretty severely, and they have almost no marketable stars. And when Ichiro, who is such a fascinating figure and the kind of guy that the casual fan of the game and someone who's just new to the game could find fascinating things out about, he has a great personality. The person who's really into stats just looks at this guy and says, I've never seen a player like him. I'll tell you, there is a rumor, or at least it was floated, that Ichiro, though special assistant to the chairman, might participate in the Home Run Derby. And I have to say, I've never been more excited about the Home Run Derby. But to be fair, I've never been excited about the Home Run Derby.
Right.
So this is the first time I've ever been excited about the Home Run Derby if Ichiro were to participate.
So if you're fascinating, you're above the law in Major League Baseball. He could walk up to the plate. He could try to get an at-bat wearing the mustache.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
That might be okay because he's fascinating.
Why are you going all Law and Order on me on this? Let me say this about baseball. Unlike our other supposed national pastime, football has no whimsy to it. And baseball, for a lot of reasons, because it is a pastoral game, because there is a 162-game season, because it comes from our agrarian roots, has a lot of whimsy to it. And I think that if baseball is to rebound, I don't know if the actual number of people going to the games will go up, but if baseball has lodged itself in our consciousness, and if it is to rebound, I think it needs to lean into and embrace the whimsy. It is a game where two of the American League's best players, Aaron Judge and Jose Altuve, can stand next to each other and look like a lowercase b, because one is gigantic and tall and the other one is short and powerful. But this is one of the joys of baseball, and I think coming down on Ichiro like the NFL would come down on a player for not wearing socks of the right length or What adjective would you use to describe the springiness of a sock? Whatever that would be.
Spongy.
That would be wrong.
I don't know.
Yeah, you know, not the adhesive qualities, but when the elasticity.
The elasticity.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh. So does baseball have as much whimsy as it used to?
I think it does, but I think baseball has perhaps stayed the same, whereas society has trended towards the unwhimsical.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's been a great polarization, whereas if you go on social media, everything is a, you know, cute goat headbutting meme. Mm-hmm. And so there's that side of escapism. But there's, of course, so much emphasis on nastiness and horror. And there's baseball sort of in the middle of it. And I think there is a chance, and I think the trend lines are clear, that if whimsy can be embraced, that baseball can really make a big comeback, especially among the youth, because it's like they say, children of the future.
Major League Baseball, where the push broom mustache passes for whimsy. He did have a short sleeve hoodie. That was kind of something.
Yeah. He's gone quasi-Belichick on us.
Indeed. That's Mike Pesca. He hosts The Gist on the Slate. It's a Slate podcast, The Gist, and one of my favorites. And, you know, we're about to talk about another. You are well-known for sports, and I hear you on NPR talking sports. But The Gist is mostly not sports, and I bet you have noticed the Sarah Huckabee Sanders make people uncomfortable in public conversation. So will you stick around for that?
I was on MSNBC talking about it today, but what I really wanted to do was talk about it with you.
On KUOW in Portland or wherever we are. Don't shine me on, Mike Pesca. Hang on then. So this is about President Trump has now attacked the Virginia restaurant that refused to serve the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Trump tweeted today, the Red Hen restaurant should focus more on cleaning its filthy canopies, doors, and windows. Badly needs a paint job. Rather than refusing to serve a fine person like Sarah Huckabee Sanders. The owner of this restaurant, the Red Hen, told the Washington Post that she asked Sanders to leave because, quote, this feels like the moment in our democracy when people have to make uncomfortable actions and decisions to uphold their morals. So when is it okay to refuse someone service because it feels like the moment to uphold your morals? With us is David Meinert. Dave owns and operates several restaurants and bars, including the Five Point Cafe. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks. Hi.
Also here to discuss the weekend's news, journalist, photographer Naomi Ishisaka, who works with Social Justice Fund Northwest, connecting donors to progressive social causes. Welcome, Naomi.
Hi.
So, Dave, you are a restaurateur. Have you ever kicked anyone out?
That's a stretch.
Oh?
That I'm a restaurateur. I own some
bars. What do you call yourself?
We serve some food.
Okay. You're a foodie. No, that's not it. You're a server.
I'm a Five Point Cafe, though.
It's okay. Have you kicked anyone out?
We kick people out daily for all sorts of reasons. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a show down there. I mean, people get kicked out for being too drunk or misbehaving poorly.
But what about your democratic morals? Is that ever involved in a kick out?
No.
Ever? Never has been?
No. Probably the most offensive person to be kicked out was Tom Likas, and he actually got kicked out and taken in the alley and beat up and put in the hospital.
Not by you.
But not by me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
Although...
Do you have people whose politics you disagree with, that they come into the restaurant and test you in that way?
At the Five Point especially, we pretty much pride ourselves on being open to everybody. We have very conservative people come in. We have very liberal people come in. I think the biggest thing is how you treat people while you're there is what we're concerned about. And I don't care how progressive you are, how much you agree with me. If you treat someone poorly, especially the staff, you'll get kicked out.
John Carlson, the KVI host, he's a Trump defender, apologist.
Correct.
No problem with you.
He comes in all the time, actually. John's a great customer.
Yeah.
We disagree on almost everything. I fought against him to make sure he didn't get elected for governor, and he's a great customer. Really nice guy.
Okay. Would you kick out Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Sounds like not.
So I think there's a line, right? So I think the difference between Sarah Huckabee Sanders and John Carlson, and this is a really hard one, and I'm struggling with the answer, is that she is part of an administration that's openly racist, openly misogynistic, and is damaging to a form of government I believe in, which is democracy. And so it'd be hard not to kick her out.
Really? Hard not to kick out Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Okay.
I think so. I'm not saying I would. I'm really interested in the show, but it'd be tough.
You're struggling. Okay.
But I'm struggling. But if she was really nice and didn't matter, you know.
Oh, if she's nice to you in your restaurant.
If she stays. I mean, it'd be hard. But also, she was in a Mexican restaurant, right?
Yeah.
Ironically. And if I was Mexican-American, I might feel like I should kick her out.
Okay, Naomi, the we have Mike Pesca on the line with us, too. I want to go to this is becoming a bigger and bigger deal because the Democratic California Congresswoman Maxine Waters said that we should be making Trump officials uncomfortable in public.
If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome.
They're not welcome, but the Democrats' House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi disagreed. She said, quote, Trump's daily lack of civility has provoked responses that are predictable but unacceptable. As we go forward, said Pelosi, we must conduct elections in a way that achieves unity from sea to shining sea. Naomi, are you more of a Pelosi or a Waters on this?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because I think that there's something about this administration and how they've put women in these positions of being out front and some of the worst policies, DeVos, you got Sanders, Kellyanne Conway, some other ones that whose names are escaping me right now. But they've put women in these really visible roles. And for some reason, people find it really unpalatable to challenge women in the same way that they would challenge men. So you saw the White House Correspondents' Dinner going after Sanders, and there was a huge backlash from Democrats who were like, oh, you can't talk about Sarah Sanders that way. It's disrespectful. It's unseemly to talk about a wife and a mother that way.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of ways, he's created some political cover for himself, or at least some sort of buffer by putting women in these positions that then people think, well, oh, we can't, you know, she's very nice person, or we can't do that to someone who's, you know, so kind and good with their kids. Well, what does that have to do with their policies and what they're standing for, right? And
kick her out of the restaurant? What do you think? You want to live in that world?
I think that I don't have a restaurant, so I don't, I'm not in that position. But I think that we should be making things much more uncomfortable on a daily basis for this administration, what they do.
Uncomfortable. The host of The Gist, Mike Pesca, what do you think about discomfort and civility and the resistance these days?
Yeah, you know, it's easy if we wanted to make this a Rorschach test where we can say, oh, what you're trying to do is turn monstrous policies into just normal political debates when you say, oh, let her sit in my restaurant. We always have differences, political differences. And if you pretend that every political difference is a unconscionable act, then you're going to have an uncivil society. But then you could turn it around and say, no, what's really going on is that these truly are monstrous acts, and the defenders are trying to tell us that these are just normal political differences. So what I like to do, I've been really thinking about this. First of all, if I had a perfect world, or a world so imperfect as to have these Trump administration border separation policies. So that imperfect, but perfect enough that restaurants wouldn't kick people out. That's a world that I would prefer. But if someone who is in the hospitality industry and runs a 26-person restaurant wants to kick Sarah Huckabee Sanders out, I would support that person, just as the Supreme Court tells me I should support the baker who doesn't want to bake for a gay wedding, or the florist who doesn't want to make a bouquet for a similar activity. I mean, as part of a civic society, I'd have to listen to what the Supreme Court says. And I think if we go high when they go low and we run a restaurant, then Sarah Huckabee Sanders gets to stay. Just one other note, if you read Trump's tweet about not eating in a dirty restaurant, since Sarah Huckabee Sanders was there and eating her cheese plate, he is saying that she ate dirty food.
Yeah, I guess that's true. By the way, the important legal point here that you bring up, Mike, you are not a protected class for your politics.
Actually, this is funny. In Washington, D.C., you are. A restaurateur cannot
in
kick
Seattle
someone
too.
Out. Yes, but this was in Lexington, Virginia, not in Washington, D.C. You need a lawyer, yeah.
I didn't know that. What's the Seattle rule?
Oh, it was in the background reading we were doing this morning.
Yeah?
Was that it's Washington, D.C., Seattle, and then one other city.
You are legally protected.
I'm stunned, personally.
For your political views.
For being refused service for your political views.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mike, I know you have to go. Mike Pesca, just one more question. This story set off a wave of 5-star and 1-star reviews of the Red Hen on Yelp. So the 1-star reviews have taken to calling it not the Red Hen, but the Blue Pig. You see what they did there, from the Red Hen to the Blue Pig? Is a restaurant that takes a stance against a customer less likely to get your business?
My business? It really depends on the quality of the cheese plate and the dirtiness of the canopy.
That's where Mike Pesca stands.
I would think a 26-seat restaurant, as long as they get sorted out, all the people who have been prank calling them with reservations, they'll be booked for some time to come, I would guess.
Mike Pesca, host of The Gist, the Slate podcast, The Gist, and it's always good to talk with you, each you or otherwise. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, let's turn local now. Mike Pesca doesn't get to join in our local conversation.
That's good.
This is in the family now. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Dave Meinert, who he's a restaurant mogul. No, Five Point Cafe, but it's more than just the Five Point.
Lost Lake Cafe and the Comet Tavern and Queer Bar and Grimm's and
mogul Dave Meinert.
New places opening soon.
And Naomi Ishisaka works with the Social Justice Fund Northwest, and both of you were at the Pride Parade this weekend, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you participated, and David, you concluded that this year's Pride celebration was boring.
No? Well, that may be a misstatement.
Okay.
What I concluded was that the corporate floats were boring. I was watching this on the subject. I was watching the parade. Which I love, and it's a great time every year. And we do a lot of stuff around Pride at the restaurants. But Wells Fargo went by, and I was very conflicted. One, it was really boring. It was like, who cares? There's a bunch of people marching in rainbows. Pretty boring to me. Two, Wells Fargo is obviously a criminal organization and supports lots of other criminal organizations.
You're talking about funding oil pipelines and such? And then when they did have fake accounts.
Stealing
as well.
From their customers' accounts.
Yes.
But funding oil pipelines. But also, it's also really great to see a corporation support Pride and support their gay and lesbian staff. Mm. So I was a little conflicted, but yeah, it's kind of boring to see a bunch of corporate floats go by. I mean, that's not really why I go to Pride.
Naomi, what do you think of modern Seattle Pride Fest?
Yeah, I was reflecting on that over the weekend, and and having gone to both the Trans Pride events on Friday up to the Pride Parade yesterday, you really see kind of the arc of the depoliticizing of the mainstream Pride events, which are on Sunday. And like David said, that there's, you know, this huge corporate pride that's now become the majority of what you see on the Sunday, big Sunday Pride event, to the point where you really don't see any expressions of, you know, the kind of politicization
yes.
that it began with, you know, in New York after Stonewall. That was the origins of Pride. And that's really changed to the point where, you know, I was at a Pride brunch and I saw a woman who was working for Absolute Vodka, like a promotion for Absolute Vodka. And she had a shirt that said, "Vote for." And I was like, oh, yay, there's something going to be like political in this. This is great. And then it said, "Vote for Vodka." And I was like, okay, that pretty much says it all about where we are now with Pride, which is just that voting for vodka as a political movement is disappointing.
Does any part of you ever think, well, this is a mark of progress, that there doesn't have to be anything political about who you love, and so bring on the corporations?
Well, I think that there's still so many areas in which queer people, and particularly trans women of color, are disproportionately affected by every negative thing that you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. Their like life expectancy is 35, poverty rate is incredibly high. So all those things still exist. And so to do this sort of rainbow washing over the whole thing is really to do a disservice to the work that still needs to be done.
So we just have a minute left. How about in a nutshell, what do you want Pride to be like in 2019? What do you want to see?
I would like to see the big Sunday Pride borrow some from what the Trans Pride did, which is bring in immigrant rights activists, bring in folks who are the most affected by the policies of the current administration and put them front and center, having them tell their stories and having bring that more to the forefront, which is how it used to be.
Dave Minert, what do you want to see Pride 2019?
Cool with corporate sponsors, less corporate floats in the parade, and more fun, creative stuff.
Best float you ever saw?
Rub-a-dub-dub, Three Bears in a Tub, which was Diesel's float, I think, 3 years ago. Pretty awesome.
Dave Minert owns and operates a million restaurants. We've expanded. It started out, he serves some food, but Five Point Cafe and others. And managing partner at the record label Onto Entertainment.
Yeah, we manage the Lumineers. It's more of a management company than a record label, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Naomi Ishisaka, journalist, photographer, communications director, Social Justice Fund Northwest, former editor-in-chief Colors Northwest magazine. Great to see you both. Thanks for talking about what happened this weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW. Produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to do this again tomorrow. I hope you can be there.